Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Lords Podcast with Will Rowe.
Welcome along to this month's Lords Podcast. Lots to discuss today, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Middlesex Managing Director of Cricket, who is also one of the current England selectors and former fast bowler, Angus Fraser. Welcome along, Gus.
Afternoon.
And joining Gus is the Deputy Editor of The Observer magazine, and more importantly for the podcast today, the author of Following On, a memoir of teenage obsession and terrible cricket. It's Emma John. Welcome, Emma.
Hi.
Great to have you here. Now, coming up on this month's podcast, Mohammad Amir returns to Lords. England's selection issues as Anderson and Stokes miss the first test against Pakistan. And we reminisce about England's trials and tribulations during the 1990s. As well as this, I put my guests to the test on the Lords podcast quiz. And we have your questions from Twitter for Gus. But first, we're now a day or so away from the first test between England and Pakistan this summer. And both sides are here training today at Lords. But naturally, much of the focus is on Mohammad Amir. He'll make his test comeback this week, having last played a test at this ground in 2010. It was during that test that he was involved in a spot-fixing incident, which saw him banned from cricket and also serve a jail sentence. Now this week sees a chance for redemption. First question. Some have questioned whether he should be playing at all. Where do we stand on his return?
I have some sympathy for him, and I'm glad to see him playing cricket again. Obviously, you can't condone what took place here those years ago, but I think there was a young man there, naively maybe, not looked after by senior figures in the side, and ended up doing something that he obviously regrets deeply. So I have some sympathy. I know there's been a lot of people saying should be life bans and stuff like that. I don't agree with that. I think it'll be interesting to see how he's welcomed over the next few days. But I, for one, am pleased that he's back playing cricket.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think with sport, ethical dilemmas are always difficult, because the whole point of sport is it doesn't actually work if you don't play by the rules. Like, sport as a whole, it's a total fabrication. Like, it doesn't stand up unless everybody abides by the rules, which is why I think a lot of people do believe in life bans, whether it's for doping or other cheating behaviour. You know, like in bridge, don't they ban you from bridge if you ever caught cheating at bridge? I think that's the case. Anyway,
life bans in bridge.
Yeah,
I've never looked into that.
But I can understand the ethical argument of that, because actually, if you say I'm not going to abide by the rules of sport, there's actually kind of no point in you being there, because you've undermined the entire thing. However, I do think that I just think we live in a realistic world where people make mistakes and people do need second chances. Everybody needs second chances, and also I think at a really difficult, horrible, fractious time like this, not just in England but in the whole world, we all need to really show a bit of mercy and understanding and reconciliation with each other, because otherwise we're all headed in a terrible place.
Is the most political start to a Lord's podcast I've ever had.
Attention again, you've got to take into consideration the circumstances. To just say there's a blanket one rule fits everybody, so say Middlesex are playing cricket, a member brings a cake into the dressing room for tea time, and the players innocently have a bite out of that cake. The drug test, they don't know there's something in it. The drug testers come the next day, and four or five of them fail a drugs test. I mean, if someone goes to the effort of that and you toss it away, then you're rude and you're not in touch with people and stuff like that. So
that's so true.
I think there's got to be some awareness. There's got to be a case by case situation, and realizing where an individual was at that period in time, or the position, or
exactly.
what the circumstances
and
that surrounded it.
The authority have, you know, they have made that decision, and I think that's where you've got to stop, isn't it? They're the ones who've had all the evidence. They're the ones who've listened to everything. Not only has he been sort of tried by, you know, in an actual court of law, he's also been tried by the Cricket Council, and they are the people who have taken all these things into account, and they've made their decision. And I think not only should we just abide by that and say, yep, that's fine, okay, if that's what's been decided by the authorities, that's fine. I also really hope that he gets a good reception here, and I really hope that nobody boos, because I think it's one thing to boo somebody like David Warner, isn't this a terrible thing to say, but I think it's one thing to boo when it's funny, and when it's, you know, when it's like, it's a kind of, you know, pantomime villain-esque thing, and, you know, whether it's Stuart Broad or whoever, that there's a little bit of humour there. I think this is somebody who has actually been to prison for what he did, and we need to have some kind of sympathy.
Well, he may well be booed, and I'm sure in time we will find out. Bringing it forward, I'd like to bring the first question from Twitter under the hashtag AskUs. Thanks for Shahib Ansari tweeting this one in. He says, how can England handle Amir? Because at the moment, 2016, sitting here now, he looks to be bowling extremely well.
Yeah, I mean, he's a fine bowler. And I think that's the thing that stood out when he was here all those years ago. It's sort of frightening, actually. I think it was 6 years ago, wasn't it? But he's a fine bowler. He's obviously looked pretty good when he was up at Leicester. Was it during the week he played up there? But I say, he hasn't played a lot of cricket recently. Right, it sort of can question sort of the form of the England batsman, but England are in a good position to decide. They've just beaten Sri Lanka. I think there's more pressure on him at this moment in time.
And with Wahab Riaz as well, he bowls over 90 miles an hour. Is there any concern maybe that the England batsman will struggle against the pace of this Pakistan side? With all due respect to Sri Lanka, they weren't the quickest bowling attack.
No, but as I say, they've got some good bowlers. I mean, that's why everybody looks forward to series against Pakistan. You're never quite sure what you're going to get. I'm sure there'll be some names that come out of this series that we've never heard of before, and you think, blimey, there's something a bit special out of them. So, as I say, if I forecast the future, I wouldn't be sat here now, would I? So, but obviously, you're backing those players to sort of to cope with what's put in front of them, and they've managed to do that so far. It's a different challenge. Yes, they are stronger, quicker. But equally, you've got to bowl well.
Well, and isn't some of it going to depend on the pitch as well? I mean, Stuart Broad this morning has been saying that he's worried about the pace of the pitch. What do you reckon?
I haven't seen the pitch. I've only got it this morning. Middlesex have been away, so I haven't looked at the pitch before now. They haven't had a great deal of pace in them this year. But Stuart Broad's been saying quite a bit, hasn't he, by the sound of it?
Yeah, but he's pointing out that nobody's taken 20 wickets on it yet.
Not this season, no.
Well, time will tell whether England or Pakistan will achieve that. Moving forward onto the England selection issues, James Anderson and Ben Stokes both unfit, so you've had to make a couple of changes in the bowling department, and in the batting you've also brought in Gary Balance, which many people thought was a bit of a shock. Could you explain sort of the decisions behind that?
Well, James finished the Sri Lanka series with a shoulder injury, diagnosed as a stress fracture. When we sat down last week, he hadn't bowled, or he'd had a couple of gentle sort of introductory bowls since. And during the winters, we've sort of said that you don't want to be carrying unfit players. That becomes a centre of discussion. That becomes a total centre of the media leading up to the game. And it's a negative.
Yeah.
Is he going to be fit? Is he going to be fit? Actually, well, hang on, there's 10 other fit blokes there looking forward to this. But that dominates the news, so... obviously Jimmy's a wonderful bowler and you try and give him as much time as you want, but I think we want to see him bowl in match conditions ideally before he to prove this show his fit before he gets back in the England side. So it's a tough call because he was outstanding against Sri Lanka and everybody knows sort of how important person he is, but say his absence creates an opportunity for someone else, and hopefully they'll take it.
Not necessarily as controversial though perhaps as Gary Balance.
No, I mean Gary, I was up at Scarborough and Gary batted beautifully against Middlesex, got 130, played another innings before that. There's going to be a jig in the order, so that's one of the things. So Joe Root going up to three, so you're looking at a number 4-5 situation. We'll be leaving Gary Balance and we think he's in a good position to do the job.
But it does beg the question of how much does, you know, one innings influence you as a selector?
Well, the fact is he was just after Nick Compton in our conversations earlier this year.
Right.
He was in South Africa.
Yeah.
So there's continuity there.
Yeah.
And there's a question from Twitter from Alex Dean. Why does Scott Borthwick not get a call up? And does Jake Ball come straight in for Anderson? So first question, Gus, on Scott Borthwick. He's been in and around the team. He's made his debut in Australia. Is there an England future for Scott?
Well, there's obviously a future there, yeah. I mean, no one's put a big black nine through his name, that's for sure. There are a number of players discussed. Ian Bell, Tom Wesley, the sort of other players as well. But we've decided that we think Gary's the right person. He's got an outstanding test career. His average is near 50 with the bat. All right, he had a lean period before.
But
our judgment that he's ready to come back and we think he'll do a good job.
And he's batted well here, actually. Balanced two test centuries at Lord's. So it's obviously ground that he likes a lot. Quite interesting in the bowling department. There's going to be a test debut this week. Jake Ball or Toby Rowland-Jones, or even both. We don't know.
Yeah.
Obviously, Toby Rowland-Jones is a bowler you know extremely well from Middlesex. What was the thinking behind his call-up? Except for, of course, the fact he's bowling extremely well at the moment.
I think he's bowled pretty well for the last 4 or 5 years. So his call-up's thoroughly deserved. I suppose you sit down, is that right? Jimmy Anderson is not fit enough to play, or he's not in consideration for this game. Your continuity is that Jake Ball moves up. Well, who's next best bowler in county cricket at this moment in time? And Toby Rowland-Jones has been bowling well, for a number of years. And his record suggests that he is a five-bagger, which he is, and he may get an opportunity. I think it'll be interesting to see. I mean, the final 11 is picked by the captain and the coach, so they'll monitor how they go in the nets over the next couple of days. And they'll make a judgment on that. So it could be interesting to see where they do go for Jake or for Toby.
Also interesting in that I discovered today that if Tobias Skelton Rowland-Jones gets picked for his test debut, he'll be the first double-barreled surname since Norman Mitchell Innes in 1935. For England.
But that was something that we considered a lot with our selection, yeah.
I know.
I'm
glad you were thinking about
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely, we thought we needed a
double barrel. I can't believe that there haven't been more double-barreled names since 1935. You just assume there would have been.
Especially with the amount of sort of public school cricketers that have come through to play for England. That's a good one. That's your wisdom knowledge coming through.
Well,
which we'll put to the test later.
Oh, no, please don't.
And as a cricket fan and working sort of at The Observer, this week when those names were announced, there must have been a bit more discussion than normally for a test squad.
I think that's right. It's interesting, isn't it, that you know, I'm coming at it from the point of view of somebody who came to cricket in the 90s, that we went through a decade where selection was incredibly, well, pick and mix, let's say.
Yeah.
And then when England were doing really well, we got into a situation where the 11 just picked itself again and again. And I think actually Mike Atherton used to say, this is all getting a bit boring.
Well,
he used to complain about it in the press box, that he was getting the same names on the team sheet. But it was just a sign
doesn't
of...
Doesn't give anybody anything to write for, but that
yeah,
doesn't mean
exactly.
It's the wrong decision,
but
does
no,
it? We're not here to...
It's a great thing. It's just an incredible thing to have stability. To be honest, it's not just this week, is it? The last year has been an interesting year, you know, with finding an opening partnership, with looking for the number three. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, cricket fans, cricket writers, we love to talk about. But
yeah.
I don't think it should... I think it's something that's easy to talk about because it's easy to compare. But, oh my goodness, I would hate to have to be the person in the selection room.
Well, the thing is, I mean, everybody's a looks, and you pick people expecting to do well, and your selection gives them an opportunity, and that's what young players want, don't they? They want opportunities. It's then down to them to take them, and hopefully they do take them, but if they don't, you give them a decent period of time so that you can hopefully make a decision with a certain degree of certainty.
Yeah.
I think in the past, you're dropping people after one or two test matches and then not knowing whether they're up to it or not, and then picking them again sort of 6 months later type of thing. But at least now, hopefully, we've got a pretty good idea of whether a player can manage and cope with what it is to be an international cricketer. And it's a lot more than just out there facing bowlers. It's coping with being the centre of the country's sort of sporting attention for
a
week.
I've got to ask this. You've been a member of the England dressing room as a player. You've been a member of the press box as a writer, and now a member of the England selection committee. Who serves the best wine?
Well, actually, there's a lot of difference there, isn't there? I mean, everybody sort of used to think that the journalists are sort of on the toot from about midday onwards, but I've never seen any journalists really drinking at all before they've sent their copy in. And there's been no booze at any of our selection meetings. I think it...
I just imagine you there with the port and
they're normally cigars. They're normally in the morning, so it's coffee and biscuits rather than port and brandy.
Yeah. Disappointing.
I think that's a good time to bring in my next question from Twitter. Why don't bowlers use the Yorker more often? It's a ball that often gets a wicket. This is from Linda Nathaniel. And I sort of hark back to days of Darren Goff, you know, steaming in and bowling those Yorkers.
Well, it's a great ball when it's bowled well, but it's a difficult ball to bowl. And you get it slightly wrong and it's a full toss or a half volley, which gets hit for four. And as a bowler, you're trying to work the percentage in your favour. A lot of the time, frustrating batsmen, not giving them much to hit. Expecting the odd ball to do something that sort of causes them problems. When you can get it right, and obviously you saw Waqar Yunus and Wasim Akram in years gone by with a reverse swing, bowling Yorkers in devastating style. But I found it a difficult ball to bowl. It's not a ball you practice all the time. You practice it sometimes. And again, I think you look at white ball cricket, the jury's still out on many occasions as to whether Yorkers is always the best tactic, this slower ball, this short balls, and things like that, because you get the Yorkers slightly wrong. It's very hittable. If you can bowl it on tap, but if you can bowl it on tap, then you could pitch any ball anywhere on tap.
Yeah.
And you'd probably never go for a run and you walk off with sort of 7 for 15 most weeks.
Great. Well, now, moving on. It's received fantastic reviews since it came out earlier this year. And we've got the author here with us today, and one of the starring cast from the book. I'm, of course, talking about Following On, a memoir of teenage obsession and terrible cricket. Emma, I think I'll bring you in here. Can you explain how the book came about? And for those that don't know anything about it, what it's about?
Okay, so the book came about partly because I had... Well, the real reason the book came about is because I just didn't think anybody had really written about 90s cricket, particularly. I mean, I apologise immediately to all the players who've written autobiographies, because they clearly have. But it's a slightly forgotten period of the game. Not forgotten. Everybody remembers it. They remember it sort of in that way that you wince when you remember a bruise or something. There are memories for it, but I didn't think that people remembered it as fondly as they should do, perhaps, because it was a difficult time to be an England fan. However, it happened to be the time that I became an England fan. Mm. I was a teenager and I completely fell in love with the game in 93 and as by extension with the England team and the cast of players. And I wanted to write about it. I didn't want to write a history of it. I didn't want to, you know.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Go and write something that was an exhaustive discussion of what went wrong with 90s cricket or anything like that, because I think there are plenty of better qualified people, most of them in the actually Sky Sports commentary box, to do that. But I do think it was a unique time to be a fan, and so I wanted to write something personal about what it was like being a teenager, and why teenage girls, boys, whoever, can do this, can become obsessed with a team, can completely become smitten with a team, regardless of their results, certainly in this case. So that's what it really is. That's what the book is.
And the book, I've read the book, it's fantastic. And I'm not just saying that because you're sitting here.
Thanks.
You go through each chapter, you go and meet one of the players from that 90s side, and you sort of interview them, and you go off on a few tangents, and you come back. And then at the end, there is the sort of the sit down. It's almost a kind of Wizard of Oz style sit down with Mike Atherton, others, who is quite normal. And it's not anticlimactic, the ending, but it's an interesting ending.
Well, yeah, so meeting your heroes, it's obviously something I'd already had to do a little bit by, you know, my first job in journalism was as a cricket writer with the Wisden Cricket Monthly, as it was then, for 4 years. And I have met, interviewed, and even, you know, sat alongside, writing in the press box, many of the people who were my 90s heroes, including Gus, who I can't quite look in the face right now while I'm talking about it. So in that sense, you know, having been a cricket journalist for a while, meeting sportsmen and interviewing them, on one level, it's quite normal, it's quite easy. However, when you are at the same time purposefully thinking back to when you were a teenager and all the, you know, the amount that you invested, the amount of emotional energy, the amount of your time. I mean, let's face it, cricket, you know, for a player it takes up plenty of time, but for a fan, you're not only spending all those days watching it, you're spending all those hours reading about it and talking about it and, you know, whining at your mum about it, in my case. And so therefore, like, meeting the players, I thought would be interesting. I thought it would be particularly interesting in terms of, I know that a player's experience is obviously incredibly different, almost entirely divorced from a fan's experience. And so it's particularly interesting in a period when you've got a team that aren't especially successful, but do have these great highs when they do win. What it is like to be, how bad it feels, what the comparison is in emotion between the player and the fan. Because for a fan, I think it can potentially be more painful. You can't, there's nothing you can do to affect what's happening on the field. Obviously, you know, I can't.
I'll be in the director of cricket then.
And I just think that it was interesting talking to Graham Thorpe, for example. You know, he was somebody who said, you know, he wouldn't have changed it for the world. And also, a lot of the time when England were doing badly, it didn't hurt so much for him because he was doing his best and he was often doing quite well and he enjoyed the adversity. You've got the challenge of that adversity. You know, you're actually actively involved and you're doing what you love and you're getting paid for it. And, you know, sure, it's depressing to keep coming up against, you know, some world-class teams who are going to beat you 8 times out of 10, say. But there's kind of personal redemption for you in it. I think for a fan, and especially, let's say, a teenage fan who is going through all sorts of weird hormonal stuff and very up and down, it's actually, there's a massive lack of control. Anyway, so sorry, that is a long way of saying meeting the players I thought was important. However, yes, sitting down and having lunch with Mike Atherton, possibly one of the most terrifying experiences of my life, despite the fact that I had, you know, met him several times before and, you know, got on well with him. But still, when you're talking about something that's been that personal to you, I think my biggest fear in all of this, and it's really nice to have the opportunity to say this, my biggest fear in writing a book like this, when you're being quite open and honest and vulnerable, is of totally being judged by the people you've written about. I mean, that's the scariest thing, is thinking, I hope that everybody who was A, involved in it by chatting to me, but also other players from the era who then go on and read it, will see that it's coming from a place of great affection and respect, which it is.
There is a certain amount of nostalgia about 90s cricket at the moment, with Mark Butcher's documentary on Sky. Obviously, Gus you were there. Can you see where the nostalgia comes from, and also what was it like to be a part of that England setup?
Well, I agree. I'm happy I played when I played. I think the 90s was, in the 80s it was definitely, you're a county cricketer that's released to play for your country. And obviously central contracts came in the 2000 onwards. And I think the 90s, there was a real jostle for space, respect, control between the players and the board. The fact that sort of the profile, the importance of international cricket was getting bigger and bigger. So therefore the necessity of the England side to be getting better and better or putting in better performances increased. And the contract dispute that we had, the World Cup, before the 99 World Cup, sort of brought things to a head in that respect. I didn't look back. I watched the Sky thing. I won't watch it again. I haven't read the book. Not because I haven't, but I mean, it's my decade, and if it's terrible cricket, then do I run a sort of people laughing at your expense? And you actually work damn hard.
Yeah.
Got a record you're proud of. In the Sky documentary, you've taken 13, 14 fifers, 2 eighths, got a test bowling average that hasn't been bettered by any current England bowler, and the only clip of you is dropping a catch at third man to make you look stupid. So, and you've got Piers Morgan slagging you off. So, yeah, it's great, isn't it?
I hope the book shows this. One of the things that I thought was most interesting about writing it is that there has never been a kind of revisionist history of the 90s and an appreciation of how actually good the team was, that how extraordinary that decade of world
the team underachieved
was.
Considerably. I mean, I think that's one of the frustrations. You look at the quality of cricketers that we had in that era, and we should have done a lot better than we should have done far better than we did, and that is down to us as players. We take responsibility of that, but there was also the way that the players were managed and looked after and maybe treated. And as you were saying, Matt, I mean, the fact that you're playing against the early 90s was a great West Indian side, and then all of a sudden that got overtaken by probably the best ever Australian side. And the fact that you're getting beaten up by the likes of Shane Warne and Alan Border and sort of the War Brothers and Ambrose and Walsh and Lara and Haynes and Greenidge and Richards and people like that. All right, you weren't as good as them, but these were two exceptional sides, and we lost. But again, there weren't any blackwashes like there were in the 80s. There weren't any 5-0 thrashings by Australia as there have been recently. So it didn't. It didn't feel like it was reported to me.
I think that's right, and I think also we had to take that decade out of the. We had to take it out of the natural thing, which has been, you're right, to sort of make it almost like comic. People liked to make it very one-dimensional and think that, you know, Phil Tufnell dropping catches, say, you know, that's funny. But that it absolutely undermines all the incredible work that happened. And also, it completely forgets that we, you know, when England did win both tests or, you know, indeed, you know, a series, that was a massive deal, and this is sport. This is what sport's about. You might not, you know, it's like Nick Hornby when he started supporting Arsenal was not supporting them in a great era. That didn't mean that he didn't appreciate their efforts any less, or he didn't identify with them any less. And it actually, you know, it can mean that you actually identify with people more, because it's not like
you look at the era and I say, well, why do you enjoy it? I mean, obviously the players are far better looked after now. They get financial security. If you've played a 10-year career, you're going to be in a good position now.
Yeah.
But the pressure they're under, the sort of spotlight, the social media, the comment, the outrage, the sort of lack of tolerance, great expectations. We could be silly so-and-sos in the 90s and get away with it. We worked hard, we were fit. We gave it our best shot, but there was space for you to go out there and have some fun and enjoy the experience of playing for England and touring these countries. Nowadays, you sort of wonder whether the current team, yes, they'll have won a lot of games, a lot more games, and had sort of certainly better bank accounts, but will they look back on it in the same fondness? Because I think we all do. I mean, in Nasser Hussain, I mean, he sort of said he wouldn't have changed it for the world. The fact that you were playing against the names of the cricketers that I played against: Warne, McGrath, Ambrose, Walsh, Lara, Haynes, Greenidge, Richards, Martin Crowe. I mean, Akram I mean, you were playing against some great cricketers, so the fact that you've actually stood there on a field and tried to take them on is something you look back on with fondness.
You didn't write a book yourself?
No, I haven't.
Did you? What did you ever think about it?
I did a tour diary book, which when I was playing, and it was ghostwritten. Yeah. And then obviously I became a journalist, yeah. So I'd have to write it myself, and I've sort of not had sort of 6 months or 3 months or whatever. I mean, obviously they're quite big investments, aren't they, to sit down and write a book. And you also, I mean, a lot of people don't, because the cash is quite good, isn't it? But you sort of think, well, actually, when you do something, it will be about your whole experience in cricket rather than just sort of something to cash in at this moment in time because someone's come up to you with a 3-book deal or whatever.
Yeah.
Not that they have.
And there's still many chapters to come. Great. Well, we're going to finish with the Lord's Podcast Quiz, which is where I give you two a date, and all you have to do is tell me what happened on that date. I'll give you 3 options. And so I'll put this out here now. For listeners, you won't be able to see that, obviously. But Emma, you can go first. And it's all about this great ground and cricket. So, in 1991, what happened? Was it A, the opening of the Compton and Edridge stands at the nursery end of the ground? Was it B, David Gower gets his name on the Lord's Honours Board for the second time in his career? Or was it C, Yorkshire's Richard Blakey makes his ODI debut at Lord's? What happened in 1991?
Oh, that is really tough. I'm going to go for Blakey because Blakey feels like a 1991 name for some reason in my head that seems to fit.
I'm going to go for A because I played in a test match here in 1990 against India when this end was demolished because who was it? Capel Devitt hit 3 sixes into this stand to avoid the follow on, didn't he? Well, that was a brilliant test match actually. Gooch 3-3-3. So I'm going to go for A.
Gus, you are correct. In 1991, well, the opening of the Compton & Edridge stand.
Well, I did have an advice.
Yeah,
that's
fair enough.
You know.
Right, our next question.
I accept that.
So Gus takes a 1-0 lead. Okay, I don't know if you'll have special knowledge here. In 1822, what happened? Was it A, did Thomas Lord die at the age of 76 in West Meon, Hampshire? Was it B, the first Oxford v Cambridge match was played at Lord's? Or was it C, Harrow were bowled out for 99 in their first innings at Lord's against Eton in the annual schoolboy fixture? Gus, you can go first with that one.
I have not got a clue.
What happened in 1822? Thomas Lord dies, first Oxford v Cambridge match played at Lord's, or Harrow skittled for 99 in their first innings against Eton?
I'll go for Oxford Cambridge.
I feel like it's going to be all three. Do you know what I mean? sound like stuff that happened in 1822. So if Lord died at 76, that would have meant he was born in, what, 48? Oh, no, my maths is terrible.
Don't overthink it, Emma.
1746, this is 200 years old.
I feel like... Okay, I'm going to go... I'm going to actually expose my complete ignorance because having been at Cambridge, if I go for first Oxford v Cambridge match and say it's that, then that's going to be the thing that's going to most expose that I don't really know anything. So I'm going to go for that.
So you're going for B?
Yeah.
So you've both gone for B. The score stays at 1-0. It was Harrow were bowled out for 99 in their first innings at Lord's.
I just realised this is why I never win anything. My strategy was terrible. I should have gone for a different answer.
If you knew, if we both knew they were right, you wouldn't be going for that.
That match was, in fact, a 2-day match, and Harrow, despite being bowled out for 99, went on to win by 87 runs. So there you go, low scoring. Finally, so Gus is 1-0 up, all to play for. In 2012, Emma, what happened? Did A, Michael Atherton ring the 5-minute bell at Lord's? B, Joe Root, took 3 catches in an innings during a Lord's test? Or was it Johnny Bairstow making his test debut at Lord's?
Happened in 2012? So embarrassing, because I really should know when Johnny Bairstow made his test match debut. I can't believe that they've ever let Mike Atherton ring the 5-minute bell at Lord's. Surely they haven't let him do that yet.
I can reveal that all 3 things have happened.
Oh, okay. I'm gonna go for B. I'm gonna stick with B. I'm gonna go that Joe Root took 3 catches.
Fantastic. And Gus?
As a selector, I should probably know when Johnny Bairstow made his test debut too, but before my time. I'll go for Atherton. A.
So you've gone for Root, taking three catches in innings, and you've gone for others ringing the 5-minute bell. You're both incorrect.
Oh, my goodness.
So Gus holds on for a 1-0 victory. It was indeed Johnny Bairstow making his Test match debut against the West Indies.
That's embarrassing to both of us, really.
And Joe Root, I can't say his name anymore, Joe Root took three catches this year against Sri Lanka in the first innings.
Three
catches as an outfielder. It's the most he's ever taken at Lord's.
Netherton rang the bell?
In 2011, the year before.
Right.
So there you go. Right, great stuff. 1-0 win there for you, Gus. Just to finish off the podcast, what have you got coming up over the next few weeks? Busy manner.
Yeah, well, obviously the Test series starts against Pakistan, although as we're looking out the window here, it's raining at Lord's, so, which has been a pretty common theme this summer. So that's there. Then, I suppose in county cricket, Middlesex, we're obviously vying for the championship, playing some good cricket at the moment, but we've got a 2 or 3 week period of white ball cricket with 2020 and 50 over returning. So the real challenge for us is to get through to knockout stages. We've not done as well as we want in that form of the game, in those forms of the game in recent years. So that's a real challenge for us as a club over the coming weeks to get through to the quarterfinals of both the Royal London and the NatWest Blast.
Well, best of luck for that. And
thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on. And Emma, yourself?
What's that?
What have you got coming up over the next, to finish off the podcast, what are you doing?
I'll tell you what I've got coming up. I'm doing a lot of research, but I'm going out to cover the Olympics for The Guardian. So I will mostly be covering gymnastics as I did at 2012. And so there will be a lot of, it's almost like doing A-level revision again.
Right.
There'll be a lot of head down in books, researching what's happened in gymnastics over the last 4 years and being ready to talk about it.
Well, enjoy that. That sounds fantastic.
Thanks.
Great stuff. Well, many thanks for those of you that have tuned in. We'll be back next month with more cricketing stories from Lord's. So remember to follow us on Twitter, our handle's @HomerCricket, be our friend on Facebook, and for all the latest news from Lord's, just go to lords.org. See you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.